from WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, we speak with Nina Burley, the New York Times bestselling author, about her latest book, Virus, Vaccinations, the CDC, and the Hijacking of America's Response to the Pandemic. Burley weaves together the narrative strands of the pandemic experience that's shaped our lives and reveals the roots of the U.S.'s politicized pandemic response. We'll chat with her live. Halima Marcus of Electric Literature is back, sharing her recommended reading list, this time about outdoor adventure. Plus, Barry Lewis of the Times Herald Record comments on the real meaning of Memorial Day. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. The Biden administration submitted a $6 trillion budget proposal to Congress this week, and NPR's Corey Turner reports that budget request includes an unprecedented increase in education spending.
Currently, the U.S. government spends more than $16 billion on schools that serve high-poverty communities. Biden's proposed budget would more than double that amount to $36.5 billion. It also would increase spending on special education, what the administration calls a significant first step toward fully funding the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. To help schools safeguard kids' mental and emotional health, the budget calls for $1 billion to hire more school counselors, psychologists, and social workers. It also includes the American Families Plan, which calls for universal, high-quality preschool. Whether any of it ultimately passes, though, is now up to Congress. Corey Turner, NPR News.
The White House is imposing a series of sanctions against Belarus over the forced landing of a passenger jet and the arrest of a journalist who was on board. In a statement, the White House says the U.S. is suspending a 2019 agreement with Belarus that allowed air carriers from the two countries to use each other's airspace, that amid other actions against President Alexander Lukashenko's government. Spokeswoman Jen Psaki is calling on Lukashenko to allow a credible international investigation. Gas prices this Memorial Day weekend, the highest they've been in 7 years. NPR's Jeff Brady reports that gasoline production and delivery is not keeping up with rising demand as more people resume travel.
Now that more Americans have received COVID-19 vaccines and infection rates are declining, they're taking to the nation's highways. AAA projects 37 million people will take trips 50 miles or more away from home this holiday weekend, most by car. That's a 52% increase over last year. Headed into the weekend, the average retail price for regular gas was just over $3 a gallon, about $1.15 higher than last year. The Energy Information Administration says oil companies aren't keeping up with increasing demand. A cold snap in February disrupted refinery operations in Texas, then a cyber attack on the Colonial Pipeline halted transportation all the way up to the mid-Atlantic. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Overseas, several scientists advising the UK government are suggesting that reopening plans may need to be postponed with the growing prevalence of a highly transmissible coronavirus variant first identified in India, as Philip Marks reports from London.
Prominent scientists have expressed concern about the UK's latest infection figures and have criticised the government for issuing contradictory advice that's confused citizens. Boris Johnson's government's insisted they'll make decisions based on data, not dates, but postponing the final easing step on June 21st could prove politically damaging for the Prime Minister.
This is NPR News. The stock market entered the long holiday weekend on a positive note. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up nearly 1% for the week.
All the major market indexes gained ground during the week. The S&P 500 index rose more than 1%. The NASDAQ climbed more than 2%. The Commerce Department reported Friday that personal spending climbed 0.5% during April. Increased spending on restaurants and recreation more than made up for a drop in goods consumption. Forecasters expect that trend to continue now that half of all adults in the U.S. are fully vaccinated and able to take advantage of services that were off limits for much of the past year. Increased demand for services could boost prices. The Commerce Department's measure of inflation showed prices in April were up 3.6% from the pandemic-depressed prices of a year ago. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Philippines says its workers can again go to Saudi Arabia. The government announced the move today after Saudi Arabia said Filipino workers would not be charged for COVID-19 tests or for quarantine upon arrival. The Philippines imposed the ban on Thursday following reports that the workers were being asked to shoulder the costs. Government data show more than a million Filipinos work in Saudi Arabia. To sports now, soccer fans focusing on today's match in Portugal between two English teams. Manchester City meets Chelsea in the Champions League final. It's been moved to Portugal from Istanbul to allow more English fans to attend the match amid pandemic travel restrictions. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, where Cezanne Drawings opens June 6th with member previews June 3rd through 5th. Tickets at MoMA.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Dina Burley is a reporter and author of six books, including most recently The Trump Women, Part of the Deal, and the New York Times bestseller The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Italian Trials of Amanda Knox. She most recently covered America under Donald Trump as national politics correspondent at Newsweek. Burley is also an adjunct professor at NYU's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute, and her work has been cited in hundreds of scholarly articles. Her new book is out now, called Virus, Vaccinations, the CDC, and the Hijacking of America's Response to the Pandemic. It's a close analysis of our pandemic year, revealing how the confluence of key government missteps, behind-the-scenes deal brokering, the staggering dismissal of decades of scientific progress, conspiracy theories, and further malfeasance were behind the hundreds of thousands of unnecessary deaths. Nina Burley joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Tim?
I'm doing well. How are you?
No complaints. Weather could be a bit nicer.
Yeah.
But
I want to read
a
quick review from Kirkus Reviews, which said, quote, "This book is a useful page-turning, blow-by-blow account of events, a worthy summary of where we've been and where we are in the pandemic," end quote. I have to ask, how intimidating was it to write a book about something that just keeps unraveling with new information every day?
Well, first of all, that's kind of what I've been doing for a living for the last 30 or 40 years. Writing journalism is writing about a story that's unraveling every day. Right, to write it into a book form that's going to be something that hopefully people will look at some years ahead. It wasn't that part of it that was so daunting. Really, it was the speed with which I had to put it together. The publisher called in around Thanksgiving and said, "I want a book on the race to the vaccines and how this came about." And I said, "You know, yeah, I'm interested in that. I sometimes write, you know, about science stories." And I said, "But I'm really interested in writing down what happened to the CDC and how this government responded to the pandemic. The politicization of the virus, the politicization of the response to it, the cronyism, the profiteering, and then yes, write about the vaccine, and then also I wanted to look into the conspiracy theories, the notion that it's all a hoax, and other really, really wild conspiracy theories that you can hear people sharing now." And he said, "Yes, but I want it by March." So I basically just hunkered down in the winter months here and just slammed it out. And I think that it was a worthy project because of what happened on 1/6 in Washington, the fascist insurrection really kind of sucked the gas out of it, out of efforts to explain and bring to account what went wrong and the people behind what went wrong in the pandemic response early in March, April, May, and so on. So I think it's important to have memorialized that for history.
Yeah, you use some colorful language to describe the administration's response, which we can't say on radio, but you also go into how the Trump administration packed public health agencies
with white right-wing Christians and political allies. Talk a little bit about how that was starting and shaping the response at the CDC and other levels of government.
Sure. Well, contrary to popular opinion, the Trump administration, or Trump, was not elected by the rabble, or, you know, the people who show up, the regular Joes who show up at the rallies. It was a two-pronged two poles of power, let's say, in American politics. One with the right-wing evangelical white Christians, who have a lot of political power because they come out and vote in droves, even though their numbers are in a minority compared to the greater population. And then the other side are the Heritage Foundation, Cato Institute, libertarian, extreme free marketeer, hard right capitalists who want no regulation and no taxation. Those two groups came together, and that's who put Trump in power. Then, as soon as he was in office, the administration needed to pay back the white evangelical Christians because they were the vote. They're the basis for the numbers. So they immediately started giving the white evangelical Christians these positions of power, especially in the kind of soft agencies like the HHS. Okay, so they put them in charge of the HHS, and then through them, the CDC. Redfield and Burks are white evangelical Christians. Alex Azar, the former HHS secretary, is a white evangelical Christian. Why were they giving them the public health agencies? Partly because for white evangelical Christians, policing morality is the goal, and they can do that through these agencies. So, for example, with the CDC and the HHS, you could cut off assistance to Planned Parenthood. You could cut off any kind of promotion of contraception. What the first thing they did at HHS was put a button on their website. It was there until Biden came in. A little click, you could click on it. It was the religious liberty button. So if you're a pharmacist who doesn't want to sell contraceptives to women, you could click on it and they would give you legal assistance. So that was on that side. So their eyes are on policing morality. They're not on a possible pandemic or any kind of science issues, because they're anti-science, right? There's a supernatural person up in the sky who's running everything. On the other hand, then you had the crony capitalists, let's say, which is what Trump is. And as soon as this virus, it became clear that it was going to be this, you know, national emergency. Their whole goal from the beginning was to show that government could be shrunk down to the size of a pinhead, which one of their donors, Robert Mercer, liked to say. So they were shrinking government. They were cutting the agencies anyway, and they wanted to show that private enterprise could do better what the government could do. So they sidelined all these government contracting rules, and they just started throwing money at favored companies. And, you know, billions have been blown on little companies that you've never heard of. The subcommittee in the House is looking into this. I was just talking to them yesterday for another article I was doing, and they're finding all sorts of organizations or enterprises that have been given billions to these small, well-connected companies that didn't really do their job in the in terms of like delivering PPE or even medical needed medications.
Yeah, and it's surprising to me that, I mean, I guess I can understand this as we look back and as you describe it, but because it was such a globally horrible thing happening, it was right in front of our face and everyone was asking for something to happen, you just had a group of people that were completely unprepared and unfocused to deal with it, right?
Yes, and you know, now you have people running around saying, well, this could have happened with any administration. It would have been in this kind of, we would have been in this kind of catastrophic chaos situation with any administration because of the way our healthcare system works. It's disparate. There's no national centralized data bank, and you know, as there would be in other countries that have national healthcare. They couldn't roll it out, testing couldn't be rolled out in a smooth way, neither would vaccines, although the Biden administration's done a really good job with that, because then they have shown that government can actually do this. So I disagree. I don't think that any administration would have responded like this. Absolutely not. I think a leader who had an ear to science and a leader who respected science, and who had tentacles into the pandemic preparedness community, in this country who didn't have, it would have made a huge, huge difference in the way things played out. And even Deborah Birx, who was, you know, the evangelical Christian in the CDC, who is also an actual medical person, she's a doctor, she's even said, 100,000 deaths probably we would have had. We did not need to have this number. We didn't. Many, many, many deaths were unnecessary. The response failed.
And you touched on this a minute ago about the anti-government ideology of part of the Trump administration or the most of the Trump administration. Folks were so enamored of like all the free market principles that they treated the pandemic as a business opportunity.
Absolutely. If you read a book called Chaos, I know that I can't remember the title now. Naomi Klein's book is about the age of chaos capitalism, and basically the concept is, you know, treat every chaotic emergency as an opportunity. It's a way to shake up the market, and you know, you in chaos opportunity for some people, and so they. That's exactly what was going on here. You know, there was this chaos, and then the chaos allowed them to say, oh, emergency, we can get around all this red tape now, and we don't have to, you know, award contracts the way that the federal government normally would require you to do, which is a process. So they just went around it and started giving money to their friends. And those friends, many of them were not friends. I mean, friends and connections in the network were not able to do for various reasons, were not able to deliver what they were saying they were going to deliver. I mean, the SBA, the Small Business Administration, had commissioned with this company down in Herndon, Virginia, called RER, to oversee they're called emergency loans, emergency disaster loans. It's a huge program. Billions of dollars are going to companies that are applying for them. This little company was given hundreds of millions of dollars to oversee the disbursement of this money, and it's just completely riddled with fraud. Like they've found out that, you know, many frauds have been not noticed, and money has been given out. People cheated, and this little company was supposed to have oversight on that, and they didn't. I mean, the subcommittee in the House looking into it, never going to get all that back. It's, you know, there will be no accountability for a lot of people who just are laughing all the way to the bank. You know, my image of the guy, it's like the guy, that picture of the guy with the little hat on walking out of the House with a Pelosi's lectern smirking. And I just feel like he's sort of the, you know, he's like the mascot of the whole thing. Like, this is, you know, we've just laid waste to the government and we're laughing because we got rich.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Nina Burley, the New York Times bestselling author, about her latest book, Virus, Vaccinations, the CDC, and the Hijacking of America's Response to the Pandemic. The folks that stormed the Capitol are part of, well, sort of, I guess, driven by a lot of right-wing media, conservative politicians, the president himself. And a lot of that thinking has left a lot of doubt for people, especially about vaccines.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other half of the book, and the other reason I wrote it was to explore why, you know, the origins of this type of resistance to medical solutions, to science. And, again, you know, the former administration had a lot to do with that. They came in with an anti-science, anti-expertise kind of mindset. And that's something that anti-science, anti-expertise, DIY kind of, you know, grandpa did it this way, so I have common sense, I'll do it this way. That mindset has been taking hold in the country for a long time. It wasn't just this Trump administration bringing it forward. It's been kind of fomented, I think, by a lot of things. One having to do with fake science that's been promoted by industry, like the sugar industry saying, well, you know, sugar's not so bad. It doesn't really cause obesity. And they trot out fake science or, you know, the cigarette companies, tobacco, saying, no, it doesn't really cause lung cancer. And they can always find scientists. Again, you know, the big example now is climate change, right? No, there are all these deniers, and they can find a scientist to come forward and produce junk science to back up this stuff. So there are a lot of people who don't know whether to believe what to believe because it's been put into their heads that, you know, this is all under discussion. You know, nothing's actually factual based in fact. And then the other part of the anti-expertise kind of response, I think, to the virus and to vaccines is really ingrained in us, in our generations. I argue that in the post, let's say, after the mid-20th century, so any of us under the age of 70, let's say, we're the vaccine-spoiled generations. We do not know what life was like around the turn of the 20th century when the average lifespan in America was 48 and 49 for men and women. Now it's like 78 to 80. What was the reason? Why is that number has changed so much? Why it changed so much? Partly because, to a great degree, children are no longer being felled by a host of infectious diseases that the names of which we don't even know how to pronounce, let alone understand what they did to children. And parents would witness their children coughing themselves to death with diphtheria or other bacterial and viral infections, measles and things like that. We don't even know what that is anymore. So because we don't know, because we're protected, we now have this whole group of people who can walk around going, I don't think I'm going to have that chemical put into my baby, or I don't want this mRNA vaccine in me because it's going to change my genetics, which, by the way, absolutely not true. It's a medical miracle what they did with this mRNA vaccine. It's a medical, man-made miracle that they made this thing in 11 months. Never before in history has this been done. And this type of vaccine is going to change the way we respond to illness and to medicine, in the creation of vaccines going forward. People are not appreciative enough of what medical science has done and the incredible leaps and bounds in the genetic scenario for the last two decades.
We're talking to Nina Burley about her new book, Virus Vaccinations, the CDC, and the Hijacking of America's Response to the Pandemic. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the lab leak hypothesis. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Last week on Wait, Wait, Nagin Farsad had a warning for men excited to finally hit the bars without masks on.
Not all bottom faces are hot, you guys. Not all bottom faces are hot.
I'm Peter Sagal. Trust me, we are all extraordinarily attractive. You can hear how hot we are on this week's News Quiz from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, it's Rachel Martin with NPR's Morning Edition. As you've no doubt heard, listener support makes public radio possible. But here's something you may not have heard. Public radio stations around the country raise millions of dollars each year from the sale of donated vehicles. That's right, vehicles of all sorts. Whether they're running or not, they can be turned into support for public radio. That vehicle you no longer need, here's how to donate it to support this station.
Donate now at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we're speaking with Nina Burley, author of the book Virus Vaccinations, the CDC and the Hijacking of America's Response to the Pandemic. It's out now. Nina, the idea of the lab leak theory about the coronavirus originating from a lab in China was generally mocked, and now it's jumped to, well, maybe that's possible as the Biden administration has ordered an intelligence review of that. Were you surprised by that decision?
I was a little bit surprised by the decision, but I'm pleased to see that they are that he did make that decision. Because so when I started out working on this, I lumped the lab leak theory in with all the other conspiracy theories that I kind of put in this chapter called Stranger Things. You know, it's a hoax. It's, you know, Bill Gates wants to wipe out half the world population and so on. And then the lab leak. And I started interviewing people about it. And, you know, I suddenly understood, and I started to see like the papers that have been written. And I started to understand that, whoa, wait a minute. This actually isn't a conspiracy theory. It's a theory. It's a theory that actually needs to be considered. And scientists were talking about it that way already in December and in January and February of this year when I was working on that part of the book. So no, I'm not surprised that they decided to release this intelligence information. And I think, you know, as you said when you brought this up, the reason that it was dismissed early on is that, well, the messenger, you know, unfortunately, the messenger was this administration that had been bullying and xenophobic and isolationist and conspiracy mongering, always conspiracy mongering. And so it was very difficult for people to get through that and say, well, but, you know, just because they're saying that doesn't mean that it's actually not an option or a possibility. The other sort of forces that were pushing against the discussion was the virology community, because if this thing did leak out of the lab in China and it killed millions of people, and that is something that the scientific community has to reckon with and really have to rethink how they are working in those labs and what they're doing and the safety levels of the labs. And that's something that they probably didn't want to have a conversation about right away. I mean, to actually admit that science, whoops, goofed and this happened is a monumental kind of thing to ask people to do. But I think they're going to have to reckon with it. They're going to have to reckon with it because I personally, having talked to a lot of people about it, think that it's very, very likely that something like that happened. It makes a lot more sense than me. It makes a lot of sense to consider when you consider the fact that this virus is closest to a bat virus that came out of a cave 7 hours by car away from Wuhan, and those bats that were infected with it, the virus itself was brought to Wuhan by scientists into the lab, and then they were experimenting on it. And what I was told was that by a virologist who heads this lab at Stanford, that who does think that it is likely, is that in these labs they do all these experiments, and sometimes they think that one maybe didn't. You know, something didn't happen in a petri dish that they wanted to have happen, so they just throw them away. And the problem is that they can miss something that might just have ended up in a trash can or, you know, it sounds incredible, but that it could be something as tiny as that, like some little mistake that somebody made. And now you're seeing these reports that there were some sick workers there who sought hospitalization or hospital care in the fall of 2019. So I think there's a lot of evidence for it. But again, it is a theory and it needs to be investigated. And maybe they will find out that it jumped from an animal to another animal that we haven't yet identified. But the science, the genetic science of understanding what viruses are and like who their next relatives are and so on is so advanced now, which is why we got the vaccine in 11 months. They literally had that vaccine developed. The mRNA strands that are in the Moderna and Pfizer's, they literally had that made 3 days after the Chinese shared the genome with the world in January of 2020. They already had the cure, but they had to do these clinical tests to see whether, you know, is it going to make everybody sick or so on. And that's how it's going to be going forward. But the ability of man to understand with these tiny, tiny, tiny nucleic, at this nucleic level, what things are, is so advanced that I think they will be able to identify at least, you know, the fact that there was no other explanation for, you know, the grandfather of this virus, how it got to where it became so infectious to humans. I think they will be able to understand that at some point, and it may implicate the lab.
Such a big subject. It's continually unfolding. Was there something that surprised you about during your reporting and writing of this book? The biggest thing that surprised you, I suppose, there were probably several things.
Yeah, I mean, this lab leak thing was kind of surprised, but I guess I would say the thing that surprised me the most and is not sort of new. It's a piece of history that I stumbled on. There's a book called, I'm blanking on the name, The Virus Hunters or something. It's by a guy named De Cruyff, D-E-K-R-U-I-F. It was written in the 20s, and the Microbe Hunters. And they, it's about just about these early, early efforts in the 18th and 19th century, the process of mankind, these European scientists finding out that, oh, diseases are caused by these tiny little things. And it had to do with lenses being ground in Holland. People, first of all, the eye couldn't see it until the lenses were started to become, you know, so you get microscopes. So the invention of the microscope, and then you had people like Pasteur and all of his, Louis Pasteur, you know, pasteurized, yeah. All of these scientists, young people, doing these experiments in their labs and starting to understand, oh, this stuff, these little tiny creatures are found in the bodies of cholera victims. And this little tiny little thing is related to tuberculosis. And it just is so amazing that this, after millennia or eons of human species on this planet, only was it 150 years or 200 years ago that we started to be able to understand what really is our enemy, just tiny, tiny, tiny things. And I just am so moved by that science history, that this is, you know, these are people and processes that we should respect and have and you know, be grateful for, instead of being doubters. We should be grateful for and sharing with our fellow friends and neighbors who maybe are doubtful about the efficacy of a thing like a vaccine. No, you should be grateful for this and tell people to get the vaccine and to respect science, because it's changed the human condition in ways we cannot understand. We living in the 21st century.
It is a fascinating account. Nina Burley is the New York Times bestselling author, and her latest book is called Virus. It is Virus, Vaccinations, the CDC, and the Hijacking of America's Response to the Pandemic. You can get more information about that book and other of her works on her website, ninaburleigh.com, ninaburleigh.com. Nina, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for giving me the time, Tim.
All right, be well. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, you too. Bye-bye.
This is Radio Chatskill. We'll take a short break and back with recommended reading for outdoor adventure.
If you hear good music, you're listening to Radio Catskill. Your weekend can't even begin until Clyde Alvin Yates III sets it off Saturday night at 7. At 9, an hour of global sounds from the African diaspora on Afropop. Then at 10, Selector Starkey and DJ Chuck spend 4 hours of funk, hip-hop, roots reggae, club classics, and more live on Old School Sessions. Saturday nights only on Radio Catskill.
This groove is dangerous.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Halima Marcus is the executive editor of Electric Literature, and she shares her recommended reading lists with us about a particular theme. This time, her theme is about outdoor adventure, and she may have been influenced by the fact that we can now go outside. Were you inspired by the fact that you can actually go outside and go back out into the world now?
I think I was partly inspired by that. I've taken my first plane ride since getting vaccinated to go see my in-laws in Florida, and there are more possibilities than there were last summer, certainly.
So let's start with your first selection, Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead, which came out in May 2nd.
Yes, it came out earlier this month. Maggie Shipstead is a novelist that I've long admired since her first two novels, Astonish Me, which is about a wedding on Nantucket, and Seating Arrangements, which is about a Cold War era ballerina, came out. They're both excellent. This novel I've been waiting for ever since I heard what she was writing about. It's an epic story about a female pilot named Marion Graves, who is a young girl growing up in Montana with this dream to fly. And later becomes the first female pilot to attempt to circumnavigate the globe by the North and South Poles. That's what's known as the Great Circle. She does that in the 1940s at the tail end of World War II. And there's a parallel plot, a present-day plot, of a starlet named Hadley Baxter, who has just starred in a Twilight-like franchise and kind of blown up her career. She, like the real-life Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson, was linked to her co-star and then kind of publicly blows that up because she's unhappy with where her career is going. And she's cast in a biopic about Marion Graves. So you have these alternating plot lines, and Shipstead uses the present day and the past story in a really exciting and surprising way in the end to bring everything together. I was, though, most engrossed by this story of Marion Graves. She goes to New Zealand. She goes to Antarctica. She goes to the North Pole. We follow a number of other characters, her brother, Julian Graves, who's a painter and a soldier, her alcoholic uncle, who's also a painter, and a bootlegger, who is the one that manipulates Marion by giving her what she wants, which is her first opportunity to fly.
And it is kind of appropriate as a time when we've all been cooped up that you're selecting this world-spanning novel. It looks like she may have been inspired by Amelia Earhart a little bit in her writing for this.
I actually heard her in an event, she gets that a lot, and she sort of wanted to shoot that down and say it's not Amelia Earhart at all. But of course, you know, you can't think about a female pilot without thinking of Amelia Earhart. She was actually originally inspired by a New Zealand pilot whose name I don't have ready, but there's a statue of her in the airport in New Zealand, and she saw the statue and thought, you know, someday I should write about a female pilot, and, you know, put that idea away for some years.
Well, I just Googled it. Jean Batten, who was the first person to fly solo from the UK to New Zealand in 1936, so honoring another female pilot.
You're quick with the Google. Thank you for that. But and Maggie Shipstead herself is also a travel writer, so she's been to many of the places that feature in the novel.
Yeah, it's great that she's able to bring those places to life she's been to them, from the Arctic Circle to New Zealand and everywhere in between, it looks like. Go ahead.
There's a line in the book about how some people just get obsessed with New Zealand, and I love that because I think it's very true. If you ever have the chance to go there, people just become like, it's like the best place on earth, and you want to set a novel there.
I love that when we talk about novels that are new, and then we also talk about some more recent novels that fit the theme. One of those is Among the Flowers, A Walk in the Himalayas by Jamaica Kincaid, which came out a few years ago in 2005.
Yes, more than a few years ago now.
Yeah.
This is a travelogue. Nonfiction about Jamaica Kincaid's trip to the Himalayas to collect flower seeds, which is a hobby or an expedition I didn't even know existed until reading this book. Really avid gardeners who want to get, exotic seeds from around the world will sometimes actually travel to those locations and harvest the seeds from flowers and then clean them and bring them back and plant them in their gardens. I knew Jamaica Kincaid from her fiction, primarily the novel Lucy and a very famous short story called Girl, both of which are about coming of age of young Caribbean women. So this is very different from what I was familiar with in her work. And she has this really spare, direct, and almost meditative style. And when that's combined with these long hikes in the foothills and then into the mountains and descriptions of flowers, it was just totally mesmerizing and soothing. And she would have these observations about the seasons and the weather and the landscape that were almost like little cones or parables. I kept thinking, I don't really necessarily need to read this whole thing. I'll read a little bit and then put it down. And I ended up going right through it, and just, I want to recommend it to people because I don't think many know that Jamaica Kincaid wrote this kind of book, and also because there is a real need for representation in the outdoors and an outdoor adventure. And so to have this kind of mountaineering travelogue by a writer from the Caribbean is also exciting.
Is it a nonfiction book?
Yes, it is. It's nonfiction. It's about a trip she actually took on assignment from National Geographic. They commissioned these series of book-length travelogues by writers to different parts of the world. So she did one for National Geographic, and it's, you know, published in hardcover like a regular book. I know it's available from our Ramapo library system because that's where I got it from.
And going from the Himalayas to the Wild West, the American West, and going a little further back, this next selection is Butcher's Crossing, a Western novel by John Williams, originally published in 1960. Why did you choose this one?
I knew John Williams from his book Stoner, which is an excellent novel about academia. So it's about a kind of depressed professor, which is, it's a great book if you like that sort of subject matter. And I was so curious to see that he had written a Western, and it had also been recommended to me for having enjoyed Stoner. So this story is about a Harvard graduate named William Andrews who leaves his job prospects on the East Coast to travel west and kind of make himself and have an adventure. Given his upbringing, he has some money, and so he decides to fund a expedition west to hunt buffalo. You know, at this time, the hides were in high demand, and there was also incredible amounts of buffalo herds just roaming the plains, and they were incredibly easy to kill. They just kind of stood there. And they could also get kind of kettled, and so it was possible to shoot many at once. So they go on this expedition and are confronted with an enormous amount of buffalo and potentially, therefore, an enormous amount of riches, and they kind of push their luck in terms of the coming winter. They need to get back to town, which is a very long ways away before winter comes. So they're testing their luck there. I don't want to give anything away about what happens, but I would say it's a very, you know, the details of their camping and how they're treating the hides and all that is very real and specific. But then the novel ends up having this cumulative effect that makes it more than just a straightforward Western. A straightforward Western being, you know, an adventure set in the West, this kind of cowboy and aesthetic, about, you know, opportunity and remaking oneself. And then it kind of becomes a story about violence and conspicuous consumption and kind of the disregard for the environment that also prefigures a lot of American culture in addition to those more fun Western ideals. It's a prescient book for having been written in 1960.
I was just going to ask if these themes have stood the test of time. It sounds like they have.
They absolutely have. You kind of think, oh, well, this is where this came from. when you read about the buffalo slaughter and they take the hides and they leave the carcasses, it's not even, you know, it's too much meat for anyone to consume, and they're killing too many buffalo to repurpose the meat. And children of the 80s and 90s may recall doing that on the Oregon Trail video game, where you could shoot too much buffalo to take back to your covered wagon.
The next selection, staying in the wilderness, but not the American West, but the Canadian wilderness. This is a book called The River by Peter Heller from 2019, about drama and suspense and possibly a murder.
Yes, it's exciting. So, like you said, it's set in Canada, and Canada is one of my favorite places to travel. I think the wilderness there is some of the most beautiful in the world. Not that I've been everywhere in the world, but I think sometimes it's taken for granted because it's our neighbor and not as far flung. So I was excited to read a book set in Canada. This one's about a canoeing trip. Two best friends, recent college graduates. And there's a couple dueling plot lines which make make it a real page turner. One is that there's a forest fire that's encroaching. The other is that they hear something kind of unusual. They see some fellow travelers, two of them, and then they hear something unusual, and then they only see one traveler that's also navigating the river. So they are concerned about what happened to that person's partner, the new partner, and they kind of get enmeshed in this scenario, which I don't want to give away anything because that's the extent of reading it. But the author, Peter Heller, uses these two plots of the encroaching fire and the confrontation with this other traveler to great effect. I just, you know, couldn't put down, kept on reading. There's actually a loose sequel to this book coming out.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because you said you would actually not recommend the sequel coming out later this year.
Correct. I read the sequel and I did not like it. It to me, I wish I'll just be frank, it to me almost read like a novelization of a movie. It was like so action-packed with like machine guns and like raid scenes and this stuff that I just felt like it didn't have the balance between the literary nature that you want in a novel with the action. It just seemed like it was something that was written to be a blockbuster movie rather than written to be a novel. So I wouldn't recommend the sequel, which is called The Guide. And it's a loose sequel, but it does exist.
It also doesn't sound very Canadian.
So The Guide is actually set, I'm not sure where, but it's in Wyoming or Montana or something, and it's about fly fishing, but it's also about some other sinister things. So it does exist if someone did read The River and wanted to continue, although I would actually, in that case, instead recommend going back to an earlier book of Peter Heller's, which is called The Dog Stars, which is a post-apocalyptic survival novel, which I thought was well done.
Do you have any summer adventures planned yourself now that we're all kind of able to get back out there?
Actually, we're hoping to do a road trip into Canada. We're actually trying to do a quite epic road trip where if the border opens up, we would drive on top of the Great Lakes to see a friend in Minneapolis and then come back down through the bottom of the Great Lakes and through Pittsburgh. So that would be a 2-week trip if all goes well. So we'll have to, I guess, get into audiobooks in that case.
I hope it's not post-apocalyptic.
So, exactly.
Halima Marcus is the executive director of Electric Literature and the editor-in-chief of Recommended Reading. She's joining us today with her Outdoor Adventures reading list. And Halima, it's good to hear from you again, and I hope you have a fun summer. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Tim. Talk to you soon.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Barry Lewis is the former executive editor of the Times Herald Record newspaper, and now he has a regular column in the Record. His next column is in the paper tomorrow, and he writes about Memorial Day. WJFF's Jason Dole spoke to Lewis about the real meaning of the day, honoring the men and women who died while serving in the U.S. military. He says it's been obscured by sales at stores and getting the right grill marks on your burger.
When I was a kid growing up, Memorial Day was, you know, it was sort of the unofficial start of summer. You know, I grew up in Brooklyn, so it was coming up to the Catskills, you know, a lot of that. You know, you would go up there as we used to say, we'd be going up to the mountains, so to speak. But, you know, as you kind of get older, you have a better sense of what Memorial Day is. In fact, again, when I was growing up, I still remember when it was called Decoration Day. And which, you know, for a lot of folks, you know, Decoration Day, Memorial Day. And it's interesting because what I realized, and when I was working at the Times Herald Record, you know, full time, that Memorial Day and Veterans Day were two very distinct things. You know, Veterans Day, you know, you remember, you're paying tribute, you're honoring the veterans. you know, and it's and it takes place, you know, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, you know, and it, there is this tremendous significance and meaning for Veterans Day, and Memorial Day, and it's a celebration. You know, we're celebrating the veterans. Memorial Day takes on a different tone. I think there are a lot of well-meaning people, you know, town officials, county officials, others, who, you know, they mean well, and they're thinking about, you know, at times parades and bands and other stuff like that. And, you know, for others, it's a day off from school, it's a day off from work. You know, merchants push deck furniture, pool floats, air fryers. You know, and it's okay to, you know, enjoy the day, take a day, you know, take a go mow the grass, watch a game, have a barbecue, but understand what the day is, and it's a day to pay tribute to those men and women who we lost in battle, and it's not a day for parade so much as it is a day to, you know, visit a veteran cemetery. Lay down a wreath. My father served in the Korean War, and he passed away several years ago. So that's where I'll go to visit him on that day. And so, you know, I think that's kind of gotten lost over the years.
What do you do to keep that memory and that perspective? So going and laying a wreath for your father, is that something you traditionally do? Do you have any other traditions on Memorial Day to kind of keep, you know, quote unquote, the true meaning of Memorial Day in your mind and in your heart?
Well, you know, I don't want to come off as holier than thou and have people think that, you know, I sit in a room and, you know, have somber thoughts. And so it's not that. And, you know, in my column many years ago, I had the real pleasure, and I mean that, there was a gentleman in Liberty named Jack Simons. For a time, he was the town supervisor, very involved with veterans associations, VFW, things along those lines. And he had served in the Korean War, two tours of duty, in fact. He received the Purple Heart, the Combat Infantry Medal. He was shot several times. And he, back in the 80s, he actually led a VFW protest of a planned parade that was going down Broadway in Monticello. You know, they were talking about having, you know, clowns and balloons and a carnival at the track. And he said to the mayor, "This isn't a day for chicken barbecues." You know, and he got the celebration canceled. You know, he said, "How can you have a festival for people who died?" And so I don't, you know, it's not as though everybody should walk around in a day of mourning. And like I said, people are off from school and they are off from work, and maybe some will go shopping. I understand that, you know, life goes on. But, you know, if you're able to, take a moment. If you have a friend or relative who not only served in the military, but died, gave their life, certainly while they were in the military for sure, was served, you know, maybe that's the day to head out to a veteran cemetery at some point, even if you don't lay a wreath. That's a way of paying respect. You know, if it doesn't take too much time out of your day, try to do that. You can still barbecue, you can still enjoy, but it doesn't hurt us to understand the sacrifice that people made. And I think that sometimes gets lost in the commercialization of the holiday, like so many other holidays. You know, the commercialization of Christmas, no one talks about, you know, in terms of any religious connotations. You know, no one's talking about Easter, for the most part, on any real religious connotations. If you're Christian, you know, it's about eggs and bunnies. Not exactly what, you know, and I'm Jewish, but that's not what I believe the Christians truly believe the holiday to mean. Memorial Day, same way. It's not about parades. It's about honoring the fallen.
My memories of Memorial Day aren't just in any one community, because in my time, you know, in print media, now recording for radio, I would be covering different communities in a listening area and really seeing how different communities honor the day. And it's a special thing to see. I guess I just appreciate the fact that the communities are doing these things, that it got me out there to be, you know, reporting on it and taking pictures and taking part of that. And that's something I always appreciate.
Yeah, and I agree. I truly believe that the intent, that there are well intentions, and I think Jack Simon said when he told me, agreed the same thing. And I've covered and have attended many wreath laying ceremonies, and taps are played, and it's a great awareness for students. So I don't think that's necessarily bad. I just think that, you know, you want to keep the pomp down, and you know, if you're scheduling, I know we have so many events, parades. I remember going up to the Liberty Cemetery and, you know, following the procession, or the Sullivan County Veterans Cemetery, also in the town of Liberty, and the events are very solemn, and you can't help but be moved by it. And if you're not inclined, or you can't make it, or for whatever reasons, you know, it's okay. Just, you know, if you're able to, during the course of a day, you know, just think about why you're not working, why you're not in school. You know, it doesn't hurt. Doesn't mean you have to, you know, suddenly sit in a corner and meditate for 12 hours. But just, you know, a little awareness never hurt. And if you've got young children, ask them what the day is. If you've got children, you know, in school, ask them, why are you off from school today? Well, Memorial Day. And what does Memorial Day mean? You know, I think it's a great learning education opportunity for parents. You know, take advantage of that and explain it to them. Chances are we all have some relative who served. And so that may be a great opportunity to pull out old pictures and to just, you know, share a moment. And for people who did serve and who I'm sure lost friends in the service, share your memories. You know, too often we lose track of history. I know that's one of my pet peeves, is people say, well, you know, I don't remember that because I wasn't born yet. Well, you know, I wasn't born during World War II, but I can give you some information about it. That's just, to me, is always a lazy excuse. Yeah, take if you're a parent, ask your kids and explain to them. Why not? I do wish you a happy Memorial Day in terms of the holiday.
Support.
Barry Lewis's column about Memorial Day appears tomorrow in the Times Herald Record and on the newspaper's website, recordonline.com. And a programming note, we'll have special coverage of the Memorial Day ceremony at the Sullivan County Veterans Cemetery. Listen during the local edition Monday at 6:30 p.m. You can find out about more regional Memorial Day services on our website, wjffradio.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Remember, be kind. Get vaccinated. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Rourke Law, Liberty, New York. A general law practice serving the Catskills and Delaware River Valley with an emphasis on estate planning, estate administration, elder law, and real property matters. RourkeLaw.com.
On the next Janice Adams Show, we're taking a path through history to Waterloo, New York, birthplace of Memorial Day and a 19th century sanctuary city.
If you're going to be a truly patriotic American, you've got to be believing and promoting human rights for everyone. Otherwise, you're not truly an American.
Saturday at noon on Radio Catskill.
It's coming up at noon, and next, Farm and Country, followed by Travels with Triggs today. The forecast, overcast with rain showers at times, high of 48. Cloudy tonight with a low 41, and tomorrow, rain is likely, high near 50. We might see about a quarter of an inch of rain. This is WJFF Jeffersonville, W233 AH Monticello, public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability,
a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.